Well, the longest serving member of the U.S. Congress in history, in the entire history of the, he served longer than Michigan Congressman John Dingell, and Congressman Dingell turns 90 tomorrow, born July 8th, 1926. You heard it here first. Actually, they've already celebrated Congressman Dingell's birthday at the Capitol, at the Rayburn Building, no less. It was a little wingding organized by Debbie Dingell, Congressman Dingell's wife, who succeeded him in Congress, of course. So 7-8-26 is what Congressman John Dingell looks at for his birthday. Still trucking, according to the Detroit News here today. Happy birthday in advance to Mr. Dingell. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome to Current State here for Thursday. Another in Current State summer travel series opens our show today. WKAR's Peter Wharf takes us to a place where Michigan's natural beauty meets books.
Chapter 1 of my day with Doug Stanton begins on a Traverse City street corner.
On the shore of Lake Michigan in front of the Traverse City Opera House, built in 1891.
Stanton's National Writers Series is a cornerstone of Traverse City's reading and writing community. Its next event is taking place in just a few hours, where the National Writers Series connects writers and readers.
We try to put a book in every hand on Front Street, here in our hometown, and that's our mission, to take reading and storytelling to the street, to Main Street. And the fact that this grand old building has been standing here for three centuries, it's been spanning three centuries on this street.
Author Doug Stanton is a local guy. He graduated high school just down the road at Interlochen Arts Academy, where he honed his love of literature and writing. Although his Traverse City ties are strong, Stanton has traveled the world and reaches countless readers. Doug wrote In Harm's Way, an acclaimed account of the World War II sinking of the cruiser USS Indianapolis. He also donned a flak jacket and followed U.S. soldiers into a war zone to write the New York Times bestseller Horse Soldiers, the extraordinary story of a band of U.S. soldiers who rode to victory in Afghanistan. Doug is also the founder of the renowned Traverse City Film Festival. And in 2009, Stanton founded the Traverse City National Writers Series. Doug and his wife and co-founder Ann bring prominent authors to the City Opera House stage and engage them in conversation about their writing life, their newest books, and the finer points of their art. For 7 years now, the National Writers Series has been a key part of Opera House happenings. Doug calls the Traverse City Opera House the city's original live-action venue, a place that's shown movies, held weddings, hosted political events, even basketball games.
It's really the heartbeat of Traverse City's arts events. We feel it's our home. If you just look at the facade on Front Street and those gold letters that say City Opera House way up on the third floor, to me it speaks, it's a majestic kind of ornament on the street. When our authors walk in from around the country, they've been in New York and or in California or Chicago, and they come here to Traverse City and they walk into the room, they're blown away. It's the best place they've ever been.
Doug's guests have included writers Mitch Albom, Sarah Chase, Rita Mae Brown, Gillian Flynn, Vince Gilligan, and dozens more, helping to build Traverse City as a literary destination.
Traverse City has become one of the top book cities in the United States for authors on their national book tours. We have some of the biggest audiences and some of the best audiences, and we do an enormous amount of outreach within the community with schools, with our media, with our libraries, with our bookstores. I'm a writer. This is an organization designed by writers to connect writers with their readers. And that's a very different kind of pioneering model. And it's always changing, and it's never the same story. But it's two things. It's always really entertaining, and it's provocative.
Chapter 2 of My Day with Doug brings us into the Traverse City Opera House itself.
Standing beneath the vaulted, painted ceiling of this 19th century opera house, and tonight we're hosting Lucy Kalanithi, who is here to talk about her husband's book, When Breath Becomes Air. written by the late Dr. Paul Kalanithi about his meditation on his life once he's diagnosed with cancer at the age of 36.
5 years down the line, I don't know what I'll be doing. I may be dead, I may not be. If you asked me when I was 17 what I'd be doing with my life, I would have said, oh, I'd definitely be a writer.
He's a promising neurosurgeon in Stanford and is given this sentence. Most people would think it's a death sentence. In Paul's telling in his book, it really becomes a life sentence. It becomes a challenge to wrench and wrestle meaning out of life. The prognosis that he has a very short time to live prompts him to write this book. And the book has caught the attention of the country. It's been 6 months on the New York Times list, often the number one spot. And it's because I think it really speaks to a central question, is how are we to live and how are we to find meaning in our life?
Yes, how is life worth living?
Right, exactly. And what he really writes, however, is a very lyrical response to that that question. It's almost as if he's writing a prose poem.
Paul Kalanithi's wife, Lucy, will join Doug Stanton on stage in a few hours to talk about Paul and her family. Family is a key theme running through today's discussion. It's also key to the National Writers Series.
Putting the flowers on stage right now is my mother, who is our volunteer set decorator. I also find my mom around Traverse City, Michigan. Hi, Mom. Come on down here. So to have my mom here and to have to actually have the discussion about this book with Lucy Kalanithi about her husband, that's also really a discussion about family. I want to introduce, this is my mom, Bonnie Stanton. We're not one family, not one family operation, but it is an operation of families. Essentially, there's a very small paid staff, but the rest of it is just a lot of people pitching in. Do you enjoy putting up the posters?
Yes, I do. I really do, especially in the wintertime in a driving blizzard.
Well, that's what Doug now leads us into the third chapter of the day, the Traverse City Opera House stage, the heart of the National Writers Series.
I love theaters. I love stages. I love a house. And I think you call a theater a house because within it, you're trying to create a family. And what we do on this stage, on this carpet, which has been here for all nearly 100 authors, is create moments up here where we feel an intimate connection with the audience. And as you look out on this stage, you see a hardwood floor filled with chairs. You see a balcony, and then you see a third tier of balcony, which goes up to the top. And to have this room full and to have these wooden walls painted white with this filigree and this finish on these vaults is really an amazing, I don't know if you can hear it, but it's a very warm room. And I just like to stand on this stage and think about it being 1920.
I was just going to say that I'm sure I wouldn't be the first to say it's a fantastic time machine.
Right.
Doug and I have lunch with Lucy, her friends. Mostly, Doug listens to stories from Lucy and her dad as he prepares himself for this evening's discussion. A reception sponsored by Traverse City's new Cowell Family Cancer Center follows, where Lucy Kalanithi mingles with guests. There's an intimacy at the gathering. Kalanithi moving from small group to group, quietly swapping personal stories with other people who've lost loved ones to cancer. Shortly after, Lucy and Doug mic up and take the Opera House stage. They share a heart-wrenching, sometimes difficult to listen to 90 minutes, remembering Paul Kalanithi through his book, When Breath Becomes Air. In the lobby afterwards, Lucy welcomes a long line of readers autographing Paul's book.
What was your brother's name?
Rob.
Making personal connections, offering comfort.
So I'm writing, I just wrote it, it's Shanti, 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 which is the last line of the poem, The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot. And it means calm despite adversity, sort of like a blessing and a send-off and a literary reference. It's the last line of that poem.
Doug Stanton's epilogue to today's Traverse City and National Writer Series journey returns us to the Opera House itself. Doug reminds us how the theater provides a voice for writers' new works while remaining a timeless place.
It is. You stand on the stage and think, okay, it's 1920 outside those windows. There are carriages. The war, World War I is going on. Or it's 1891 and this house has just opened.
It looks that way.
Right. It does inside. When I was growing up in Traverse City, this was all rafters and pigeons. This was in complete disrepair. And a group of citizens came together. And I don't know if you can hear that, but those are seagulls circling the ceiling. They've just flown in from the bay a couple blocks away.
Doug Stanton smiles. It's another beautiful summer day in Traverse City. His National Writers Series season finale is tomorrow night with screenwriters Jim and Lynn Kauf. For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
And coming up on Current State, more than a century ago, America's mining communities were sometimes the sites of labor unrest. An MSU labor history expert says one Michiganian's activism makes for an unusual chapter in state history. Professor John Beck explains the strange cases of the red flags and the man at the center of both of them. That's on the way. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thank you for joining us. Unmanned aerial vehicles, drones, as most of us know them, have been around a long time. The first true remote-controlled aircraft were developed a century ago during World War I. Today, drones have evolved from reconnaissance patrols to recreational pastimes. The FAA has recently published new standards for hobbyists and commercial drone operators. The rules don't take effect until August, but they'll supersede countless local ordinances established across the country, including cities like East Lansing and DeWitt. Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me now with more. Kevin, what's in the new rules exactly?
Mark, like a lot of federal regulations, there's a lot of minutiae, which I won't bore our audience with. The rules do deal with things like a drone's maximum weight and altitude at which an operator can fly, things like that. To learn more, though, I met with Ryan Lauderette, who owns Capital Drones in Grand Ledge. Ryan and I met about a year ago for a previous story I did on drones. This time we went to Crego Park in Lansing to test out his newest drone. And so I asked Ryan why it's been so challenging determining who gets to use the airspace above our heads and how.
And that's always been the question. The FAA has been behind the eight ball on this, whereas other countries have put forward regulations in quite short period of time. The CAA, the Canadian counterpart to the FAA, has had drone regulations for both hobbyists and for commercial operators for more than a year. So I think it's been a lagging of heels on the part of the FAA, and they're just now getting around to it, unfortunately.
There's a couple of municipalities in mid-Michigan that do have their own ordinances that govern drone use. East Lansing is one. DeWitt is another, as an example. To be safe, we decided to go to the city of Lansing and not East Lansing to do this drone flight today, because there are still some concerns about the language of the ordinance in East Lansing. Does the East Lansing ordinance mesh with what the FAA has put out?
The East Lansing ordinance basically regulates such that they do not allow hobbyists to fly. They only allow commercial operators to fly under certain conditions. And in both cases, they are trying to preempt federal law. I've made the decision that I will not fly in East Lansing, not because I don't think that it's legal for me to do so, but I'm not willing to fight the court battle that would have to take place in order to prove my innocence.
So if you were doing a gig for a particular client, that would be all well and good if you were in East Lansing, but you couldn't do that just for fun, you're saying?
To an extent. So even if you were doing it commercially in East Lansing, what they would still require is particular approval from the FAA, which obviously has not yet occurred. That doesn't happen until August. So there's nothing that would prevent me from doing it with the FAA, but does prevent me from doing it with East Lansing. In addition, they have some regulations that you are not able to fly over a city-owned property or over somebody's private residency without their permission.
Well, that sounds reasonable to me. That's an expectation of privacy.
Could be. When you think about privacy, understand that the Supreme Court has ruled on multiple occasions that there can be no expectation of privacy in a public place. So if you're sitting out on your front porch, I'm sorry, you're not in privacy. You are out in a public place. You can be seen. So if I'm flying in the air and happen to spot you with my camera, I could take a picture of you. Now, I'm not into that kind of thing, but that is possible. The other concern would be, at what point does it become a privacy concern versus a private property concern? If I'm flying at 300 feet and flying over your house, am I actually trespassing on your property? Imagine, if you will, having a Cessna airplane in the air, flying at 300 feet or 500 feet, and going over your property. Should you have a say-so as to whether or not that plane has overflight capability over your property?
A plane that size over my house at 500 feet, you betcha I've got a say in it.
And the FAA would say, no, you do not. The FAA, difference of airspaces in the United States. Here in Lansing, the majority of our airspace is Class C airspace, and that is all from the blade of grass on up. And it requires that airplanes stay above 500 feet unless they're in the approach to the airport, and they have to be in communication with the air traffic control tower. For a drone, as a hobbyist, I would have to call into the air traffic control station, let them know my intent to fly, contact the air authority as well, letting them know my intentions to fly, and I need to stay under 400 feet.
Ryan Lauterette is the owner of Capital Drones, and we're talking about the regulations that the FAA has just come out with in the last couple of weeks. They're not final until August, but they do supersede, in the eyes of the law, any local ordinances that includes cities like East Lansing and DeWitt. Why don't you fire up your here next to the lake at Crego Park, and you can tell me what it is you're legally allowed to do with this drone.
Sure. So right now I've turned on the remote control to give us a link into the drone system. Up on the iPad that is connected, I've pulled up the application that will power the drone and allow us to control it. I'll turn on the drone. Makes noise, and it's going to adjust the camera to a level setting on the gimbal. The gimbal keeps it nice and flat, so I have a picture that's able to stick with the horizon. And then on the application, I'll actually pull up the camera so that we can see exactly what the camera sees. All right.
All systems go, Kevin.
All systems go. Let's fire it up. So I'm going to do a little bit of pre-check here to make sure that we're good to go. I'll check all my controls, forward, the sides, back. Up and down, we'll spin it around one way and the other, and it looks like we have full control of the aircraft, so we can let it go. And then as it's up in the air, we can check the camera, see what it's seeing. This application will tell me how far we are away from the unit and how high it is. So right now, if I'm peeking at this, it looks as though we're only at about 80 feet or so, and we're running about 60 feet away from us.
So you've got this computer screen in front of you, Ryan, but the FAA rules also mention visual line of sight. Is that physically with your eyes, or is that also, are they talking about electronically aided devices like what you have in front of you? Do you have to physically see it with your own eyes to have control
Absolutely.
Of the drone?
So yeah, there is the requirement that you're going to have to fly line of sight and visual line of sight. So right now, we're not very far above the earth, and so we can see this spotted against the blue sky. It's a white drone, and it's clearly visible. If I were to fly this quite a bit higher, and let's go ahead and we're going to get up here quite a bit. We're going to stay under 300 feet, and I'll take it in front of a cloud. We can still see the drone. There's a loss of visual quality somewhat. It does have some contrast against the cloud, but it is still white on white. And the concern is if you're going to get it up that high or further out, you're going to start to lose sight of it, not where it, know where it's at. And some people will rely on the screen as their visual cue. Here on the screen, we could see the lake. And if I'm moving around, we could see the lake move around. But when I start to tip that, I might get lost in orientation, and when I look up in the sky, I don't see it. Now I'm a potential hazard to an aircraft that's flying over.
So to get back to the local ordinance versus the federal rules, if I were a drone operator like you, living and working in East Lansing or DeWitt, in light of the new publication, what would I be most concerned about?
Well, I think, one, when this does happen at the end of August, there's also going to be another rule that comes out, and it's from Congress, and that's the FAA Reauthorization Act. In that act right now, the language stipulates that all information or all law pertaining to this act supersedes or preempts any state and local authority. And so this will automatically invalidate any ordinance that the city's put forward. And so once that takes place, East Lansing is pretty much moot.
No appeal process?
None. The federal law always trumps state and local authority, no matter what.
Do the local ordinances pretty much jive with what the FAA is saying now? Are there subtle differences? Are there glaring differences?
I think there have been. So take, for instance, DeWitt. I went to DeWitt and spoke on behalf of the drone community to try to get that ordinance thrown out. One of the things that they originally had in the ordinance was that you could not have a camera on your drone. You could not take video or pictures with your drone. And we go back to the First Amendment, especially if you're a journalist, that's a real problem. If you are not able to use your camera to take pictures or video, what's the sense of having a newspaper? You're going to write the words, but it's probably going to be helpful if you have some visual aspect to go with it. So we were able to throw that out before they passed the ordinance. But in many cases, yes, they do try as much as they can to mimic what they see as are the coming federal regulations. And I think part of the reason they were doing that is because at that time, the federal government, or FAA, did not have regulations. So they were trying to get ahead of the game and put something in place. Now they're behind the game, or they're behind the FAA and need to drop those ordinances.
And I know there are special provisions if you're law enforcement or fire personnel. You can't interfere with a police investigation or a traffic accident scene if you're a drone flyer. But who polices law enforcement? I know that sounds like a baited question, but is it up to people like you in the industry to also be sure that the authorities who have, for lack of a better word, the authority to fly drones for those purposes, are also abiding by the law?
Yeah, actually, I think when you're talking about accident investigation, a crime scene, a fire, I think most in the drone community will say that it's important for a drone to be there. Not just as you're definitely not looking to harass anybody, but you're documenting it, citizen journalism. But I think more so is that we can be so much more helpful than people realize. In the case of an accident, you're going to be able to not only take a picture or video of the aftermath, but you might get a sense of the layout, the topography. I can do mapping with the drone that then could be provided to the incident manager that helps them in that investigation. Similarly, with fire, for example, if a fireman arrives to a scene of a fire, they have to do a 360 walk around of that property before they can get started with the firefighting efforts. Well, that might be okay if you're a single-family dwelling, but what happens when you're a large distribution center? That could take a long time. With a drone, I can get it up in the air. This drone in particular can fly at about 50 miles an hour. I can circumnavigate a distribution center in a heartbeat and then leave it in the air to help the incident manager navigate where their best use of assets are. I can track where the firemen are at any time and be able to suggest to the fire personnel, hey, it looks like this area is flaring up. You want to take a look at the screen? So, yeah, the drone community is really supportive of that idea of use for emergency situations.
Have you ever been called upon to do that?
I have made offers to do that. I have not yet been taken up on those offers, but I hope to eventually.
Maybe the climate will change to where that is seen as mainstream, normal, needed, and appreciated.
Absolutely. That's the hope. You know, as I look at it, some of the things that these things can do are amazing. search and rescue. I can cover a wide area of space in a short period of time, be able to find something. I know that I have some drone community friends that have actually saved lives with drones. One case in particular, flying down in Texas during the flooding, he was able to spot a vehicle that had been taken by some water, and he was just flying as a hobbyist, checking things out. He was then able to put a tactical flashlight on the unit and direct the fast water rescue team to the truck. 2 hours later, they called him and said, "Hey, we have a mobile home that's being inundated with water. We can't get to him. Can you fly a rope over to him?" And sure enough, he tied the rope to his drone, flew it over to the homeowners, and they were able to be safely evacuated.
How about we bring your drone back in for a landing, Ryan? We'll get a little sound of that. We've been talking with Ryan Lauterette, the owner of Capital Drones, about the new regulations from the FAA that actually take effect in August. They were just published a couple of weeks ago, and how they will be superseding local ordinances such as those that are already in effect in East Lansing and DeWitt, among other places across the country. Ryan, thanks for the explanation and for a great day of drone flying.
And thank you, Kevin, for inviting me out exactly about 1 year later, I think.
We have to do this more often than just 1 year.
Well, definitely.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
On the way on Current State, the Wharton Center brings some Broadway professionals to teach kids from across Michigan this summer. It's a week-long program called Take It From the Top. We'll visit with the Wharton's education director, a Broadway leading actress herself, Chris Ouellette. That and more after the break on Current State. Funk sound there of Pat Zelenka performing the song Chitlins Con Carne on a Live Music Friday about 3 weeks ago here on Current State. Tomorrow on Live Music Friday, we welcome country singer Shelby Ann Marie, fresh off her gig at the National Cherry Festival in Traverse City. She's landed a spot on American Idol. She's opened for Trace Adkins and Craig Morgan and the band Perry. Shelby Ann Marie here in Studio S on a Live Music Friday tomorrow. Here on Current State, we hope you can join us. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Our next guest has spent a good deal of time recently exploring a fascinating episode of Michigan history. Twice in the 20th century, the Michigan Supreme Court heard cases involving red flags. One man was at the center of both cases. Folly Berman was an American of Scandinavian descent living in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. He was a socialist and activist, supporter of labor unions, and he learned the hard way about the importance that people assign to flags, in this case, red flags. John Beck's an associate professor in MSU's School of Human Resources and Labor Relations and is a student of labor history. He spent a lot of time looking into Folly Berman's place in labor and Michigan history. John, welcome back.
Thanks, Mark.
So July 28th, 1907, this is 109 years ago this month, Folly Berman is a young labor activist living up in Copper Country. He's 25 years old or so, and he's arrested for marching in an apparent solidarity parade in Hancock, Michigan. And this is apparently on behalf of striking miners in Minnesota. The case eventually makes it to the Michigan Supreme Court later that year. What's he charged with?
He's actually charged with disorderly conduct. So he and another nine defendants were in a solidarity parade, and they were specifically carrying red flags. They were trying to test an ordinance that had just been passed a few weeks before in Hancock, outlawing the actual flying of red flags. And a lot of that comes out of the fact that the Copper Country here in Michigan has always really thought of itself almost as a separate province, a law onto itself. Hmm. Huge amount of benevolent paternalism on the part of mine owners, and a strong conservatism in that community that was much tested by the fact that more and more immigrants were moving into the copper country, many of them with radical beliefs by comparison to the locals, specifically believers in socialism that were coming out of Finland and elsewhere in Europe.
In 1907, what does the average Michigan resident think about labor organizing? Is it on their radar at all?
Well, labor organizing had been around for a while, but most of it was craft organizing. The big fear in the Upper Peninsula on the part of a lot of mine owners was that there was going to be at some time kind of an insurgent labor movement based in the copper and iron mines. There had been a strike in 1895 in Marquette on the iron mines, but for the most part, the Upper Peninsula's mines were fairly quiet when a lot of other strikes were going on across the United States, either in coal in the east or in hard metals in the west.
And how did a disturbing the peace charge end up making it to the Michigan Supreme Court?
Well, the local attorney that was working with the labor movement and with the socialists in Hancock and Houghton area, Patrick H. O'Brien, specifically wanted the red flag law to be tested. So he was already ready to take an appeal of whatever kind of conviction came out of that specific solidarity parade when it occurred. So he decided to take it all the way to the Michigan Supreme Court. He really wanted to test the red flag law, but they never actually arrested them for flying red flags. They arrested them for disturbing the peace. Mm.
So it goes to the state Supreme Court, and Folly Berman is fined $25.
Right. All of the rest of the people. Now, Berman himself is not that important among the group of people who are arrested. It's order of arraignment. So he ends up, his name goes on the Michigan Supreme Court case, though he is frankly not the leader. The leader is a man named Leo Laukey, who was very much a very strong, very famous Finnish radical who ran a paper called Tiomis, which was The Worker, which is a major Finnish radical paper of that time. And he was based in Hancock, and it was published in Hancock.
And does the first state Supreme Court ruling have any impact on the red flag law?
No, because the fact that they weren't out, they never allowed the law to be tested. So in that way, ultimately, the Michigan Supreme Court upholds the local court's belief that they had been totally in the right in the way that they tried and convicted Berman and the rest of the defendants. So in that way, they simply affirmed the lower court opinion.
And in the ensuing 25 years or so, what happens to Folly Berman?
Well, interestingly enough, he moves out of the copper country, moves over to the Ironwood area, where he's an organizer for the Western Federation of Miners, the mine working union that ultimately is the group that takes the copper miners out on strike in the very significant 1913-1914 copper strike. But he's a district organizer and then district secretary for the union over in the Ironwood area. But then in 1914, he actually moves to Chicago, becomes a carpenter. And over the ensuing time, not only is he in Illinois, but he rises within the kind of the Finnish Socialist Federation, but then becomes a communist when the many of the Finns become communists after the Russian Revolution. And he becomes a fairly significant Finnish-American communist within that part of the party. He runs as managing editor a couple of different Finnish radical communist newspapers. He is a very important official on different boards for the Communist Party. So he's a fairly significant guy before he moves back up to Eben Junction.
We're talking with John Beck, associate professor in MSU School of Human Resources and Labor Relations, about the strange journey here, the extraordinary journey of Mr. Folly Berman and his place in labor history and Michigan history here. It's the case of the red flags. Two times it went to the Michigan Supreme Court. So we fast forward to 1933, more than a quarter century after his first case is heard by the state Supreme Court. Yet another case involving Folly Berman is heard by the Supreme Court. What's the second one about?
Well, he moves back to Michigan in 1931 to Evan Junction. He's specifically brought in to run what's called a unity co-op, which is a division of cooperatives within the Finnish, a larger cooperative commonwealth, as it was called, that was much more communist-oriented. And he's really, I think, a district organizer for the Communist Party in the UP. So they run a young pioneer camp, which is a camp for kids of communist parents, at the local Finn Hall, and they fly a red flag over that hall when the kids they sing the Internationale, they do a flag raising of it in the morning, that kind of thing. And ultimately, the state police are called in by local deputy sheriffs because of this red flag, because it is against the law in Michigan to fly a red flag. And so the police come, they chop down the flagpole, they confiscate the flag, and then they tell them not to do it again. The next day, the kids re-erect the flagpole. They sew together four red bandanas. They then raise the red bandanas as a flag, salute that, sing the Internationale. The state police show up, confiscate the bandana flag, and cut the flagpole down again, and they break it into stove lengths so it can't be erected. And Berman is the local cooperative store manager. He comes walking over and saying, "What you doing about that flag?" At that point, he's punched in the stomach, and they arrest him and the teacher that's running the summer camp, a guy named Unto Immonen. And both of them then are put in the local jail. There's nearly a riot the next day when tear gas is used on a crowd of Finns who are threatening to break him out of the local jail, and they're dispersed. Ultimately, the two men appeal their case to the Michigan Supreme Court after being found guilty and put in Marquette State Prison under hard labor.
Under the red flag law.
Under the red flag law. And ultimately, the case is overturned by the Michigan Supreme Court. Michigan Supreme Court finds that the lower court had erred in putting these men's communistic beliefs on trial rather than simply their connection to the red flag. Mm. And it's overturned. Both of them, you know, ultimately are of course, let go. I think they might have been out on appeal at that point. But then Berman dies in 1937 at the age of 55 of a heart attack, which is really interesting from the point of view that at 55, he still had years ahead of him, I think, within the Finnish communist wing of the party, or generally within the Communist Party. I think that he very well may have had a brighter future for himself because he had already been a very strong functionary within the Communist Party.
You've taken a pretty deep dive into this chapter. Has your exploration of the Berman cases unearthed anything new here, or is it more accurate to simply call it an overlooked episode of Michigan history?
I think it's probably an overlooked episode, but the pieces were not necessarily put together. I think it's one of those things that there are numerous stories that go on in the history of Michigan, and often some of them are sidetracked because they very well may be, frankly, not the dominant story. So in this case, the story of a socialist turned communist involved with red flags very well may have been not necessarily a story that people were all that interested in telling.
And what importance do you think we learn of here? What do we learn by studying these red flag episodes?
Well, I think that it's interesting from the point of view that beliefs around political extremism, beliefs around what it means to be different, even from the point of view of diversity, these things kind of continue to resonate in American history, both in the past and in contemporary times.
John Beck's been our guest. John is an associate professor in MSU's School of Human Resources and Labor Relations. He's a student of labor history, and we've been talking about the extraordinary journey of Michigan's Folly Berman and his place in labor in Michigan history. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Mark.
Imagine making a contribution that leaves a legacy to WKAR for generations to come. Well, a donation into an endowment will create long-term support and lasting impact. Learn more at WKAR.org, and we thank you. It's Current State on WKAR. If you know a kid who just can't stop dancing, singing, being slightly overdramatic, the Wharton Center might have something to better channel all that energy. Current State's Jamie Paisley spoke with Chris Coop-Ouellette, the Associate Director of the Wharton Center's MSU-FCU Institute of Arts and Creativity. It's quite the title. And Ouellette uses her experience as a Broadway actress to put on a one-week-long intensive training session for young thespians. It's called Take It From the Top, and it's been going on for 7 years.
Which is really exciting because each year we've been able to fine-tune the program and add in things that address the needs of our community. So this year we're actually adding in a junior advanced class so that the younger kids who still have pretty great theatrical experience already are able to work on building character and developing all that sort of thing in a focus on one single musical. So the preteen program this year, ages 9 to 13, will workshop 13 the musical while also taking classes in dance, voice, acting, and improv around that focus.
Now, the program is 1 week long, and traditionally, you know, if it's a bit of a boot camp, then it's you're working on the triple threat, singing, dancing, and acting. But it's not just focused towards those that are young learners that are working towards Broadway. It's just also creative outlet and finding those as well. It's not just heavily focused, you're going to get a job at the end of this. It's how to improve yourself as an actor and being more comfortable in front of stage as well. That's part of the take it from the top approach, yes?
Absolutely. Learners with any kind of focus, yes, a lot of the students that we do have are interested in pursuing performing arts as a career. But a lot of the students, other than that, are interested in learning how to improvise, which is a life skill. If you have to suddenly be in front of people and are asked to make a presentation or that sort of thing, it's a really useful skill. We really develop confidence. That's one of our main focuses. Operating on a shoestring budget is a life skill that you can get out of theatrical work. Just thinking creatively and comfortably. Again, it's the triple threat discipline, you said, song, dance, and acting, which I liken also to mind, body, spirit. So we're developing all three simultaneously, and it's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
To help facilitate this, you actually have guest artists that come in that are Broadway performers, and you've had a number of very legit guests, certainly.
Yes.
And this year is no exception.
This year is no exception. This year we actually have a record number of 7 teaching artists coming in directly from the stages of Broadway. We have a musical director this year who was the author and composer of Altar Boys, which ran forever.
That's right.
Off-Broadway. And he was also the musical director for Avenue Q on Broadway when it won all of its Tonys. His name is Gary Adler. Paul Kanin, who is the co-creator of the program, will be coming in as a teaching artist again this year. He most recently was the dance captain in Kinky Boots on Broadway. There's no question that who you know in show business is as important and sometimes more important than what you know. It's incredible, but I got to spend some time with the Lord Andrew Lloyd Webber this past week when I was in New York, and Cameron McIntosh's secondhand man, a young man named Seth Sklarhein, and the star of the London production of Les Mis right now, who will be bringing Miss Saigon in. And it's because even though I've been away from New York for about 3.5 years because of programs like this, I remain pertinent in the city, and I want to give these students every opportunity and their parents to take advantage of my connections and make their lives in the theater a little bit easier.
Yeah. And as part of that, you're also kind of coaching students that are part of this Take It From the Top at the Wharton Center program, how to film things to go off to the New York casting agents as well.
That's right. One of our primary focuses is the audition for students who don't wish to pursue musical theater as their career, still need to do a college video, I call it audition, but it's sort of an interview submission. And so we work on that very carefully to make sure that what they might know already gets taken up 12 notches so that when they are applying for schools, mom and dad can trust that this kid has been coached expertly. Also, the videos from our auditions get kept on file at a New York casting agency for a year. And we've had offers for jobs, major jobs, come out of that bit right there from Telsey Casting. We had students who were offered positions in Elf the Musical on tour, the Broadway production on tour, and Kinky Boots. All of our 9 through 13 year old young men were given a chance to audition for the leading role of the character as a young man. And already we've seen results from that aspect of this program.
Yeah. Now, the focus of Take It From the Top for the week-long program that we've got, the younger version, the junior version of Take It From the Top, and the still kind of high school-age kids. And they're certainly still developing. Puberty is still raging the hormones and adjusting their bodies throughout the years.
That's right.
This. And so you have to take in consideration, of course, anybody that's considering being part of Broadway, the abilities of the young learner. And I'm speaking mostly as a vocal education person myself, that I get nervous when I hear that kids are doing Defying Gravity and mm-hmm. Let It Go. That's something to also educate about, that these are still developing performers. That's part of the approach, I assume, as well.
That's correct. We emphasize healthy dancing, healthy singing. We focus on selections of music that have a story that those individuals relate to, as opposed to a giant vocal range. And at the same time, if that's exactly what that student wants to learn, we make sure that they approach that kind of singing and dancing in a healthful way so that there's no damage done when trying to do something that's self-expression.
Yeah. Now, at the end of the week, you're going to be having performances of these musicals as well. There's 13, the Jason Robert Brown musical, which we talked about. There's also the Gershwin collaboration of Crazy for You. Is that available for the public to view?
It is. On Saturday, both of those advanced classes will perform their recital in the afternoon, and it's free to attend. On Friday evening, the 29th, we'll have our preteen and teen students do something that's sort of a variety show presentation, where they will do solo songs and group numbers and improvisation things in front of the audience, some scene work, and demonstrate what they've been working on all week long. And both aspects of the performances on Friday and Saturday are really, really wonderful to watch. We get such a huge response from parents saying, when I sent my child here at the beginning of the week, I thought that he or she was already a star. And the growth, the measure of growth, it's a thing in the room. It's obvious, and it's wonderful that parents get some real gratification out of being able to participate in this program. We do have an adult program. It is a one-night-only $30 thing where the adults we've had students, adult students from age 21 through 86 participate in this program. Okay. And some who are people who never, ever, ever wanted to professionally pursue theater. Some are already professionally in theater. We have students that just want to sing karaoke sometimes or just hang out with really cool people from New York for an evening. And we do a little bit of improv. We do a little bit of choreography. And at the end of the evening, people are able to workshop 16 to 32 bars of a favorite song. And that's where we focus on the storytelling and some vocal technique. It's stupid fun, I like to call it. People get in a little nervous because they're not sure what to expect. But by the end of our first improvisation game, friendships are being formed, and it's pretty spectacular.
Yeah. So three different levels as part of Take It From the Top, provided by the Wharton Center. They're from Monday, July 25th through the pretty much that week for both the junior advanced and the advanced levels. And then there's the single night only of the 21-plus adult learners. More information about that at whartoncenter.org. Chris, thanks very much for stopping in and talking with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And
And that's our show for today. We're glad you could join us tomorrow, Live Music Friday, on Current State. Michigan marks the return of Civil War volunteers and battle flags to the state with events at the state capitol on Saturday. Current State Scott Pohl looks at the history behind those battle flags with Dave Downing of the group Save the Flags. Plus, fresh off a gig at the National Cherry Festival in Traverse City, our Live Music Friday guest, country singer Shelby Ann Marie. At age 15, she landed a spot on American Idol, and since then she's opened for Trace Adkins, the band Perry, Craig Morgan, and others. We welcome Shelby Ann Marie to WKAR Studio S tomorrow for another great Live Music Friday. Hope you can join us. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Katie Cook directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Jamie Paisley, Kevin Lavery, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. Remember the Current State podcast, informative, insightful, indispensable, with stories from around the state of Michigan and maybe even your hometown. The Current State podcast anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get those podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day. We'll see you Live Music Friday here on Current State.